Is this in my
city? Go ahead and hit the next slide. My background is I've worked in doing embedded system design, and then I've also done IDS development and vulnerability assessment. And this talk is go back one. It's entitled Advanced Evasion of IDS Buffer Overflow Detection. There's lots of network IDSs out now, and they're using very simple methods to detect for remote buffer overflow attacks. This talk will cover ways you can simple ways that you can change your exploit so it won't be detected by current signature detection network IDSs. One more. So this is the topics I'm going to cover. There's going to be a brief refresher on buffer overflows just to get everyone back in sync. I'm going to talk about IDS signatures, how IDSs are detecting how the signatures are written. I'm also going to cover various stealth coding techniques for remote buffer overflows. No, go ahead. This is what I'm not covering. Lots of people have talked about different network IDS evasion techniques that were covered in the SNI paper, the Tom Tocic paper, about IP fragmentation and stream reassembly not done properly. I'm not covering those things. Those have been covered enough. This is the outline. We're going to start off covering on how the stack works, how we overwrite return addresses. And then as an example, I'm going to look at the system call kernel interface for Linux to see what we have to do to make our overflow code execute system calls. Then we'll go over the three parts of buffer overflows. Then we'll cover what the IDSs are actually looking for. So then once we know what they're looking for, then we can use that information to create our stealth techniques for each part of the three parts of the overflow. After that, we'll cover what IDSs could do to do this better, what their response would be to some kind of attack like this, and then as an attacker, what you can do to go past their prevention. And finally, I'll have some questions and answer session at the end. All right, this is the stack, as you've probably seen 1,000 times. High addresses are right here, low addresses here. When you enter a function, all your arguments are going to be pushed onto the stack. Then the return address of the location after the call instruction will be placed on the stack. Then the stack frame pointer, and then your local variables. Usually when an overflow happens, there's a unbounded buffer here, which allows you to write up this way. And the target you're aiming at is this return address that's in red. If you can control that, you control the flow of the program, and you can make it point back into your local variables. Once that happens, any code you want can be run on the system. Commonly after a buffer overflow, you'll either exec a shell, you'll bind a shell to a port, you'll write to a file. There's numerous things you can do, and there will all be in the context of the process. So the process is running as root, then when you exec a shell, it's running as root. to exec a process, we use the exec VE system call. All the exec calls under Linux, there's execl, there's a bunch of them, but they all go back down. Execve is the system call. The other ones are just, there's library front ends for them. So everything goes under this call. In Linux, the interface is interrupt 80. You set up parameters to pass to the kernel. Then you execute interrupt 80, and then it'll process your request. These registers right here is what you need to pass to the system, to the kernel. you put B into EAX. That in the system call table is the exec VE system call. EBX is going to hold the address of your string, binsh. And these addresses are real addresses. These are not offsets off your code. So later on we'll see how to get real addresses and not offsets. This will hold an address of a pointer to binsh or to the whatever string of something you want to execute. And then here we need the address of a null somewhere in memory. In order to get physical, I mean not physical, but real addresses, not offsets, we need to do something called jump call mechanism. This is because we need real addresses of the bin sh, not offsets. A call instruction is going to push the address of the following instruction after it onto the stack. So that's going to give us a real address to work with. And what we do is we place the bin sh string after the call instruction, so then we'll have the address of the first location right here. So what we do is when we start executing code, we jump to this call instruction. The call instruction is going to jump back to the address right after the jump, and what gets pushed onto the stack is the address of this first location. So now we have physical address, we have real addresses in order to put them into those registers and be able to exec the call. This is some basic shell code. This came out of Alf One's paper, Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit. I'm sure a lot of you have read it. It's from FRAC 49, I believe, Article 14. The same mechanisms here. Here's the jump, and here's the call. After the address of the... this gets pushed onto the stack. Right here, we put it into the ESI register. Then we take that address and put it A locations after the ESI register. That's going to hold the location of the pointer to this, because we need the address of this plus a pointer to it plus a null. We then clear out EAX, set it to zero, then copy this seven locations after this, which happens to be right here, and that's how we terminate the string. So now it's null terminated, because we can't send nulls across, because it'll terminate the string and terminate the buffer, and we won't get the whole thing in there. After that, we put a 4-byte null 12 bytes after ESI, so that gives us the other thing we needed, which was an address of a null. Then we put B into AL, which is the bottom half of EAX, and we have the correct number for the execv system call. Then we copy ESI to EBX, and that holds the address of this. Then we load up the addresses that we've already written previously back into these registers and execute interrupt 80. And this is the whole execv system call. After that, this part right here is an exit system call. In case for some reason this the execv system call fails, we want to have an exit system call so we don't keep on pulling stuff off the stack and crashing the system. So basically, this says zero there, sets zero in EBX, and then sets one in EAX, and also calls interrupt 80. On a success of an exec VE, this should never return. Okay, in order to for the return address to point to our code, we don't know exactly where in memory it is. So what we do is we build what's called a no-op sled, and that's coined after the x86 instruction no-op, which happens to be hex 90. So we filled the buffer with hundreds of these and then try to get the return address to point somewhere within there, and then it'll just slide into our code. No-ops are used because they're one-byte instructions. So because x86 uses multiple length instructions, it's one-byte instruction, so the alignment will be correct. We won't hit invalid opcodes and fault the processor. So now we see there's three parts of a buffer overflow. We have a return address. We have our payload, which will, in most cases, exec a shell. We have our no-op sled. Now we're going to look at what IDSs are looking for. There's different types of IDSs. Some look for traffic patterns that differ from a norm, called anomaly IDSs. These are very difficult to set up because you have to know your network very well. Most people won't go through the trouble of setting it up. Then there's signature-based IDSs that look at known signatures. These are the vast majority of IDS is out there, like Real Secure is signature-based, Snort, which is a free IDS, is signature-based. And a lot of these will have something that looks for future attacks by looking at strings such as binsh. So they tell you, like, okay, if a new buffer overflow attack comes out, we'll be able to detect it because we look for certain patterns that exist in buffer overflow. So no matter what comes out, you'll be protected, but that's not the case. Here's some sample signatures from Snort. You can't see right now, but the address for Snort's here. It's snort.org. So this is what they're looking for. These bytes here coming across the wire, and this signature right here is for happens to be for WooFTP 2.4.2 for an exploit written by ADM. Here's another interesting signature is they're looking for strings of no-ops, long strings of no-ops, which usually will signal that there's a buffer overflow. This one down here is looking for some no-ops and what looks like it could be a jump or for a slash bin sh. This slide is going to show the comparison between a signature and exploit. So basically what you have is here's an excerpt from the exploit. This is part of the shell code you'll see at the beginning of the exploit. So all they're looking for is just a slice out of it. So they take, you know, look at all these different exploits and try to find a particular slice of it that won't match other ones, and then that's how they try to narrow down what's going on the network. All right, so this is the part where we look at how to make all this stealthier. We're going to go over each of these three parts and look at techniques of how to make each of them stealthier. looking at lots of exploits, you'll see the return address is copied multiple times. Sometimes half the buffer will contain copies of the return address. And with my testing, I haven't seen why this is necessary. I've written exploits that just have one copy of the return address. If anyone knows if there's a good thing about this, why it would be convenient, please like let me know, come up after or whatever. I'd really like to know. I don't know if it's this first person that wrote it just did it like that and then everyone else copied it, but I've written it with just one return address and it works. So if you just have one return address, it doesn't look as suspicious. If you have multiple copies of these return addresses, it doesn't look like normal traffic. So just if you can, use one return address, especially if you know the size of the buffer, you know how much data you have to send, just use one. These are the techniques for the payload. You can change the offset or the order of instructions since they're looking for exact sets of data in a certain order. You can also use different instructions for the same objective, use different registers within instructions, or you can encrypt the payload. This is part of an exploit. It's clearing out the EAX register. Then this is the part where it writes the null at the end of the string and also writes the null at the end of the 4-byte null and puts B into AL. What you can do is just change the order of some of the stuff. You move this up, as shown right here, and it's going to produce a different output. So this, although simple, is going to change the signature. You can use different registers within instructions. The classic alpha on paper uses ESI, but in protected mode, you can use any register as base index pair, so it doesn't really matter. If you pop into EBX, then you save yourself having to move the address into EBX later. So in essence, you're making your shell code smaller. So it's a small optimization by doing some of these. different instructions for the same objective. There's two examples, one's here and one's here. instead of doing like a callback, you can clear the register, put that into the register, and call through the register. It's a little bit more code, but it does the same thing. It's going to change. It's also going to change the signature. Instead of doing an XOR to clear EAX, you could subtract from itself. That's also going to do it, and it'll also change the signature. Now the encrypting of the payload. If you encrypt the payload, it's obviously going to change the signature because it's going to be encrypted. This is good for the generic signatures. If it's looking for binsh, if you encrypt the payload, it's not going to be binsh no more. And the exploit unencrypts itself once it hits the stack of the machine. So it's the exploit is going to have a header that's going to decrypt the payload. And when I say encryption, I'm not talking real encryption. I'm talking something very simple. I mean, all we're trying to do is fool the IDS. This is not anything that's secure. It's just very simple encryption. So these are the simple types that I've been using. Some variant on ROT13, XOR with a constant, or XOR with a variable, so you keep on XORing off the last one. Here's the architecture that I'm using. At the beginning, we have the decryption header, and then we have an encrypted payload. The first thing that happens is we do a jump to this call. Once we do the call, then we know the address at the beginning of the payload. Then we go into the decryption header. The decryption header, what it's doing is it's reading data from in here, either ROT13ing or XORing and writing it back. So this keeps cycling. And then at the end, all this is back in clear text. And then you jump back over and begin executing your payload. Here's some sample code for a decryption header. Here's the basic jump and call. So it's going to the initial jump, and then you do a call, and then now on the stack you have the beginning address of your payload. You put this in ESI, then you clear out ECX. ECX is what we're going to use as our counter for how many instructions we need to decrypt. The code that I wrote at that time needed 2D. That's how many instructions it was. So we put this in CL. What we're doing here is we're getting the encrypted byte from the payload, which would be down here, reading it in. This is doing ROT7, so it just adds it in, and then we write it back out, decrement our counter. If the counter is zero, then we jump over and start executing instructions. It's very simple, but it's enough to get past the IDSs. There have been self-modifying shell code around already. A lot of times when you have to do it, there's filtering, like if there's a two upper, which I think some older IMAP exploits you had to do because it wouldn't let it, it was filtering for two upper. Sometimes MIME filtering, and someone pointed me out to Lamagro's site, which he had some kind of encrypting shellcode, but would only encrypt binsh. And while that's pretty cool, you need to encrypt more because a lot of times the signature is based on the early instructions, which is just the setup for the shell code. Now, the no-op sled. We didn't need to look at what exactly the no-op sled is for. It's providing instruction alignment so that we don't end up in the middle of a instruction and cause a processor fault. And it also needs to not affect the outcome of our code. So these are the two key points that a no-op sled needs to provide. Here's a sample signature that we also saw earlier that is looking for strings of no-ops. So anytime there's all these no-ops, the IDS is going to trigger. And most IDSs will have something like this. Okay, now to make the no-op sled stealthier. Instead of no-ops, we don't need to use a no-op. We can use other one-byte instructions that aren't going to affect our exploit outcome. So there's lots of 8-bit instructions that we can use there that, as long as they don't affect our exploit, is going to have the same outcome as if we use NoOps. Another thing we can use is what I call instruction stacking, is that you build larger byte instructions out of smaller ones. So you can have 2-byte instructions where the offset is a valid 1-byte instruction, and you won't fall no matter where you land. So once again, they're used because they're 1-byte instructions. And here are some other 1-byte instructions that we can use that will not affect the outcome, like clear the carry flag, clear the direction flag, set the carry flag, set the direction flag. There's a few others. I just listed a couple here to show as examples. So you can pad your buffer with these, and it'll have the same effect as a NoOps sled. This is instruction stacking. So what we're doing is we construct multiple-byte instructions out of smaller ones. And this allows valid opcodes to be executed regardless of where the instruction execution starts. Another advantage to using this is that this is going to increase the entropy of our NoOps sled, making it a lot harder for someone to write signatures to be able to detect it. I don't know if you can see it in the back or not, but here's an example. If the return address happens to land here, this is X31, XF8. So this comes out to XOR EDI and EAX register, which will have no effect on our shell code. If we happen to land here, this is clear the carry flag. So in essence, this whole thing is just one big NoOp. And it's longer instruction, makes it harder to detect. And no matter where you land, you're not going to fault, and you'll be able to execute your NoOp sled. GCC sucks for writing exploits. A lot of instructions aren't supported. 8-bit offset instructions aren't supported. Loop is not supported. If you're going to write exploits, use NASM for optimization. It supports the full instruction set. You can't see it here, but here's a link to the GNU page talking about GAS, which GAS is the assembler built into the GCC. And here's some instructions that it does not support, especially some of the smaller byte displacement instructions. So yeah, don't use GCC, use NASM. And what is IDS developers going to do to counter this? Well, they're going to look at the decryption header, and they're going to try to write a signature for the decryption header. But the difference between like an IDS and a virus scanner, the goal of a buffer overflow, if written properly, is 1-to-1 ratio. There's one attacker is trying to break into one system. The virus writer is trying to spread across multiple systems and wants to be on all these systems, so it has to spread. So if you write custom exploits for each of these machines that you're attacking, then there's no way that the signature detection is going to work. To do it properly, it should be a little more intelligence. Let's say there's no reason to have, let's say on a POP3 server, have a username that's 2K long. That's wrong. It doesn't matter what the data is in there. You shouldn't have something like that going on. So if IDSs start looking for that kind of stuff and do proper protocol decoding, then they'll get better results. As attackers, what are you going to do to counter when they put a signature for your decryption header? Change the header. I mean, if you write assembly, you use some of the earlier techniques, change the order of the instructions in the decryption header, it's going to produce different signature. And that's it. You can't see the webpage, but it's right here, www.newhackcity.net. I'm going to put up this presentation probably a little later today, as long as when I can SSH back into my account, I'll copy this there and just click on my handle and it'll take you to my webpage. There's also a white paper that'll be out by the time I get back to the States. So look for that in about 2.5 weeks. And questions? Anyone? Questions? I got free t-shirts for questions. Can you say that again?
What about cache and self-modifying code? Is there any difficulties with this?
I haven't found any yet. I've been testing it. I originally did this a lot of this code for DEF CON because I did a presentation at DEF CON, and before then and since then I've been doing a lot of testing and I haven't run into any problems. Go ahead and pull out a shirt, throw it out. Oh, right there. Question? This has to be a good question. You know. Okay, that's a good point. That's why I was asking why I have multiple return addresses. I wasn't really aware of that. Go ahead.
The answer to the first question, I think, is there are a lot less machines today that have a separate data and instruction cache. We're going towards unified cache architecture.
If you look to things like FOC or ARM or whatever, where you don't have cache coherency, you except for the cache coherency problem, you're also running into the fact that instructions can also be relied on FOC or on Moodle or FOC or ARM or also you cannot move.
Well, actually, it makes it a lot easier to write the exploit because you don't have to deal with misaligned instructions. So that's the advantage. And of course,
yeah.
On a Spark machine, you have to interject no ops anyways because Spark doesn't do proper pipelining. So you may have to manually put in no ops to make sure you don't have instruction collisions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you want to come forward? Because I can't throw that one.
Yeah. I'll just pass it down.
Go ahead.
When I have a low-bridge Linux server and I will install IDS system, how many performance tech is installation away from my server?
For, are you talking about a host-based IDS or network-based IDS? Because usually for network-based IDS, the good thing about network-based IDS is that you don't take away any load from your server machines. You just throw it on the network, and it's watching there. There's a lot of people going towards host-based IDSs because you can tap into the different network layers, and you'll automatically get reassembled packets that are specifically for that machine. So some of the other attacks like IP fragmentation and breaking apart streams will not work. I haven't really looked too much at like a kernel-based host system on Linux.
What do you prefer for Linux?
I can't really say what I prefer because I'm under different NDAs for different products of companies I've worked on, so I can't really comment on that. All right, that's it. All right, way in the back. Well, if you have a non-executable stack, this of course is not gonna work. You can't use all these evasion techniques. You can use the changing the order. You can do the stuff of the different registers, but obviously you're not gonna be able to. People still do like jump into libc to avoid some of the non-executable stack, but this is really not, doesn't really relate to this.
Okay.
All right. Like, just come up at the end or something.
Okay.
All right, I'll take the last question, which is over there. No. If you look at what IDSs are looking for, it's really, really simple. So to use a more complicated encryption or use multiple encryptions, you're not going to get any benefit out of it. And like, just don't use like, you know, double rot 13.
And also, what you want to try is to make it as short as possible. So.
Well, see, the thing is that IDS is not going to be looking for packets and then trying to decrypt them. That's not the intended purpose of it. So as long as, you know, this is not real encryption. This is encryption. Like if you look at, you know, applied cryptography, there's two types of encryption. There's a type to keep your sister out from looking at your stuff, and then there's real encryption. This is a type to keep your sister out of your stuff. All right, I guess that's it. Thanks.